Welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. This episode of the Great Books Podcast is brought to you by Belmont Abbey College and its Great Books program. I'll tell you more about that in just a few minutes, but first, let's talk about The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Our guest is Daniel Ross Goodman, an ordained rabbi and doctoral candidate at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in New York. His short stories have appeared in more than a dozen literary journals, and he also has written for the Wall Street Journal, the Jewish Review of Books, and the Harvard Divinity Bulletin. He joins us by phone as we record from the studio of Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Daniel, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thanks for having me, John.
So tell us, why is The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde a great book?
To answer this question, I'll start by borrowing the Italian writer Italo Calvino's first definition of a classic, which is a book about which we usually hear people say, "I am rereading," and almost never, "I am reading," meaning that a great book is a book that has so seeped into the cultural consciousness that even when people are reading it for the first time, they know so much about it because it's so become part of the culture that they're really rereading it. And Jekyll and Hyde is absolutely one of those books. It's a cultural touchstone. It's become part of the English lexicon, a term we use in daily life to describe someone who seems to act one way one day and another way another day. Even a football team that plays great one week and poorly the next week is called a Jekyll and Hyde team. That gives you some idea of just how influential the book has been. But beyond its enormous cultural influence, Jekyll and Hyde is a great book because it possesses what all great books possess, and that's either great characterization, in other words, the way a writer develops characters, or a great plot, or a great literary style. And Jekyll and Hyde possesses at least two of those three. For a novella that's essentially a potboiler, it's written with a terrific literary style. Stevenson is a master at building suspense, at creating mood, at using carefully selected words and imagery to evoke feelings of the uncanny in readers. And in terms of the other two, while you can nitpick Jekyll and Hyde's characterization, you can't dispute the spellbinding nature of its central story and the way the plot unfolds. It's a great mystery story, one of the great works of detective fiction. Stevenson uses the conventions of the mystery genre to terrific effect. It's a classic metamorphosis story, like Ovid's and Kafka's metamorphosis stories. For fans of horror, it's a great monster story. It ranks up there with Frankenstein and Dracula as one of the most memorable monster stories in literary history. The way it portrays fundamental universal concerns, like the perpetual struggle between good and evil, and the persistent nature of the duality inherent in humankind, is unforgettable. And quite simply, the story is captivating. It hooks you right in from the beginning and doesn't let you go. And in these days of the shortened attention span, it has the extra advantage of being short. It's only about 70 pages. Henry James called it a masterpiece of concision. All in all, it's a great read.
Now, we're going to talk about all that. We're going to talk about the story, the characters, the genre, a little bit about the author, Robert Louis Stevenson. But let's dive into the story itself. It begins with Mr. Enfield and Mr. Utterson, and they're walking through London. They come to a building where the Enfield recognizes, and he describes a horrific incident that had occurred there, the beating of a child by a man called Hyde. And when Utterson hears that name, Hyde, he recognizes it. What happens next?
So then the conventions of the detective genre start to unfold. There's a connection that Utterson believes between Hyde and somebody he knows, a client of his. He drafted a will for someone. He doesn't want to come forth and say who it was. But he wants to investigate who this Hyde is. They don't want to say publicly because they want to maintain this Victorian propriety of not ruining people's reputations. But he kind of suspects that it could be his friend Jekyll, and that sets in motion the whole plot of slowly piecing together the connection between Jekyll and Hyde.
And initially, the concern is that Hyde is extorting Jekyll.
Yes. There is a check that Hyde comes to pay off. He draws a check to pay off the parents of the family of the child that he trampled, and the check is signed by Jekyll. So at this point in the novella, we don't know that Jekyll and Hyde are really the same person, even though in our cultural consciousness it's become so part of what we know that these are the same person.
With this check, we discover there's a connection between Hyde and Jekyll. But of course, we already know that as readers. This story is almost folklore. Robert Louis Stevenson writes it in such a way, so there is a moment of revelation later in the book. But we know it's going to happen, right? You don't need a spoiler alert for this.
Yeah. We know exactly what's going to happen, but the genius of it is how he slowly makes this connection apparent to us. And to go into the book knowing the end of the story makes it all the more brilliant to see how Stevenson actually slowly weaves it together.
Now, what do we know about Henry Jekyll? He's a doctor. What kind of doctor is he, and what do we know about his character?
Yes, we know that he's a medical man. We know that he's a good, decent, upstanding person. He's very respected in society. A pretty ordinary man, nothing completely extraordinary. But we know that he engages in some kind of experiments that the other doctors in his medical fraternity either frown upon or are very puzzled by. His friend Lanyon, another character in the book, a doctor friend, says Jekyll's experiments are becoming kind of fanciful, and he's engaging in scientific balderdash.
And then there's Hyde, his alter ego, as we know. What do we know about Hyde? What do we learn about this character initially, and what happens with him?
Initially, the first time we see him, he's described as a small, deformed man. His appearance is simian. He's ape-like. He's hairy, savage. But there's this aura of mystery about him, and even among the few character descriptions we get, the other characters don't really want to describe him too much. He's in some ways beyond description for some of the characters.
Robert Louis Stevenson wisely leaves that up to our imaginations, doesn't he?
Yes, and he also leaves up to our imagination the axe, the evil, cruel axe that Hyde engages in. We know he commits these acts like trampling on this young girl. We don't really know the nature of that crime. So this aura of dread, mystery, fear, that really is heightened by the way Stevenson describes him and doesn't really describe some of the crimes he does, and leaving it up to our imagination to fill in the details.
So the book begins with that trampling or abuse of that girl. Again, it's a little vague exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Then some time passes and there's a murder. Who dies, and what do we learn about that incident?
This character named Carew is found dead about a year after the events of this trampling occur. And here is where the connection between Jekyll and Hyde, these two characters who start out in the novella as two and are eventually revealed as one, this is where the connection really starts to be revealed. The murder of Carew, this character, on him we find a cane, a stick. Utterson, the main narrator of the novella, it belongs to the character Utterson. The stick that was used to beat Carew, and we also find a letter that implicates Jekyll in this murder. Even though the act was committed by Hyde, this is known, the stick that was used to murder him, Utterson knows right away, was a stick that, a cane, a staff that he had given to Jekyll. So now all of a sudden we're starting to say, okay, and Utterson starts as well to say, okay, now we really know what's going on here.
So the characters are starting to put together the connection between Jekyll and Hyde. We as readers already know about it, and we're gonna turn to that question in just a moment. But before we do, I want to tell our listeners about Belmont Abbey College and its Great Books program. This is a new program. It's at the Catholic Benedictine College near Charlotte, North Carolina. Belmont Abbey College has just launched a new Honors College, and this distinctive program prepares students for an exceptional career through a flexible, robust, great books education. The curriculum focuses on the great conversation among the most influential ancient Christian and modern authors and culminates in a unique senior year dedicated to considering the various crises in the West. Students can choose 4 years of study committed exclusively to the great books or elect a traditional major while also taking a substantive great books core. Honor students will study abroad in Ireland or Italy and foster lasting friendships centered on the shared pursuit of truth. A scholarship covering nearly half of the college's tuition is included. For more information, visit belmontabbeycollege.edu/greatbooks. A life well-lived awaits. Now, Daniel, we're talking about a very troubled life with Dr. Jekyll and the revelation that Jekyll and Hyde are one. And that brings us to the major theme of the book. There are so many themes in it, but really the obvious one, the overarching one in a sense, which is the question of duality and the divided self. What are we to make of this theme in Jekyll and Hyde?
Yeah, this is arguably the main theme, and it's a battle raging within Jekyll's mind and soul. Jekyll puzzles with it. Stevenson is puzzled by it. He grapples with it. Jekyll says towards the end in his confession last chapter, he learned through this whole experiment and trying to isolate the evil part of himself and try to remove it from himself, that man's nature is really two, is not one. The book tells us that Jekyll, this medical man, good man, man of science, he was troubled by his dual nature, his evil side, that even though he was a good, upstanding society man, he had these darker impulses. And part of the experiment he wanted to engage in creating Hyde, which was not an intentional act, that's another important aspect of the book, of the novella, that readers may not realize that he wasn't necessarily trying to create this evil part of him, but what he was trying to do was to find a way to isolate and remove the darker, disturbing, more troubling aspects of his dual nature through his scientific experiments. And what ended up happening inadvertently is by isolating those elements of himself, he created this character, Hyde. He would morph into this evil side of him and then engage in these darker passions that perhaps his good side, his good nature, didn't want to engage in the light of day.
So is this a botched attempt at perfectionism? Is Jekyll trying to perfect his character and that's where things go desperately wrong?
In some ways, you can really say that is. It's probably a botched attempt to deal with evil, to deal with the darker aspects of ourselves. There's always been this question in religion, in philosophy, in ethics. How should we deal with our darker impulses, with our primitive instincts? Should we try to completely remove them, suppress and repress them? Should we not really try to engage with them at all? Or should we try to channel them somehow into some proper avenues, and Jekyll's solution is to try to remove them, to isolate them, and that definitely does backfire in this story.
And now we come to the next theme, or really sub-theme, I guess, of the question of duality, which is the Freudian interpretation of Jekyll and Hyde, that this is a kind of allegory of repression and hidden desire and so forth. And this book was I think it was written before Freud was really a prominent influence. But
yes.
Help us connect the dots on this one. Is that a good way to look at Jekyll and Hyde?
Oh, it definitely is. It's definitely a story of repression and hidden desire, and can be read in this Freudian way. Even though Jekyll and Hyde was published in 1886, and Freud, as you mentioned, started writing later, he didn't publish his groundbreaking interpretation of dreams for about another 20 years. The things Freud was saying about repression and hidden desire, they were definitely in the air. The poet W.H. Auden wrote a poem about Freud where he called Freud a climate of opinion. The concepts of repression and subconscious desires were in the philosophy of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. These ideas were in the air of Europe at the time and beginning to percolate into fiction. And Jekyll and Hyde is almost a preview of Freud's civilization and discontents in fictional form a good 40-plus years before Freud wrote it. Freud, in Civilization and Discontents, was arguing, among other things, that while, yes, we've made tremendous progress and created this amazing, technologically advanced, modern, sophisticated society in the West, it's come at a pretty steep price, which is the repression of primal desires. The more civilization you have, the more repression you have, because in order to have civilization, first farming and agriculture, and then industry and technology and the modern market economy, you need everyone to come together to repress their more primal base desires in order to create the order you need to have all these things. And having all these things are great, but it leads to the repression of individual instincts, and that creates a lot of discontent, a lot of unhappiness simmering under the surface. Nietzsche was making similar arguments in his work, Birth of Tragedy, and some of his other philosophical writings a generation earlier. And Jekyll and Hyde is a prime fictional portrayal of this dilemma. 19th century Scotland, Stevenson's background was one of the most modern civilized societies in the Western world. The Scottish Enlightenment was one of the most successful locales of the Enlightenment, producing Adam Smith and David Hume, among other luminaries. But the Enlightenment's emphasis on rationality at the expense of irrational passions, modern civilization's emphasis on order and the needs of society at the expense of the desires of the individual, and Puritanism's and Victorian morality's emphasis on severely restricting pleasure all conspired to create conditions that were ripe for a moral revolution, a kind of rebellion. And Jekyll and Hyde can be read as a work of fiction about one such rebellion, about what happens when you try to repress and isolate the dark, irrational passions we all have.
So Jekyll creates a monster. He doesn't mean to. It's kind of a mistake, right? There's a chemical impurity with the material he's working mm-hmm. with that he's trying to experiment with. But we also have here, it seems, a story of science gone wrong. And you mentioned Frankenstein earlier, a much earlier novel, a great classic of science fiction and horror, and of course we get Frankenstein's monster, one of the classic monsters in literature and later in movies. This also, it seems to me, has some very similar themes to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, particularly the idea of scientific experimentation detached from ethics.
Yes, it's one of the great themes of the novel. It was one of the great preoccupations of the era. Both Frankenstein, by the way, this is the 200th anniversary this year, 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, so it's very apropos to talk about and tie it in as well. One of the concerns of the era with the development of modern science and modern medicine, and at the same time the concomitant downclining, the loss, progressive loss of traditional religious beliefs was this concern that, well, now we have all this science and technology, but as people slowly began to lose some of their religious beliefs in the West, not completely, but just starting to lose them, what will happen to science and technology and modern medicine? How will we use these things? How will we use them for forces of good, or even if we intend to use them for the good? We don't know what the end result will be with our creations. It's kind of the age-old tale of Prometheus, which is Mary Shelley's, it's her epigraph to, or rather the subtitle as well, to Mary Shelley's story of modern Prometheus. What happens when you steal fire from the gods?
Well, when Dr. Jekyll tries to do it, nothing good is the result, obviously. Now, you mentioned the loss of religious faith. This book is actually full of biblical allusions and theology. Unpack that for us. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's actually a very religious work. It's not necessarily obvious that it's a religious work, but it is. Stevenson embeds many subtle biblical and theological allusions into the text. But there are also plenty of overt references to religion as well. There are references to the Day of Judgment, sin, repentance, hell, Satan, so forth. Stevenson even builds an extended metaphor between Jekyll and Hyde and the biblical story of Jacob and Esau. Jekyll, like Jacob, is smooth-skinned, and Hyde, like Esau, is hairy. Jekyll, like Jacob, is ordinary and decent, while Hyde, like Esau, is savage and animalistic. Stevenson even writes that Jekyll and Hyde struggled within the womb of Jekyll's consciousness, which is a clear reference to Jacob and Esau struggling within the womb of their mother, Rebecca. So religion is a clear and present player in Jekyll and Hyde, which begs the question of why and what is it doing. And it's doing three primary things. One, the references to sin, hell, Satan, damnation heighten the gothic feelings of fear that Stevenson is trying to conjure. Secondly, it allows the novella to be read as a kind of Dantesque descent into a hellish netherworld of London. And three, and perhaps most importantly, it accentuates the drama that comes with this dread of not knowing. And here's where Stevenson's Calvinist Scottish Presbyterian background is crucial for an understanding of Jekyll and Hyde. Calvinism and Scottish Presbyterianism believe in a form of predestination that says God chooses before we're even born whether we'll be among the saved or among the damned, and there's really not much in life we can do to influence that divine decision. So the fear and anxiety of not knowing whether or not one is among the saved mirrors and underscores the fear and anxiety of not knowing the true nature of other people. In other words, maybe a good, upstanding Dr. Jekyll is not really who he purports to be. Maybe your seemingly decent next-door neighbor is really a Hyde. This is the theological atmosphere that Stevenson's both working within and attempting to conjure in the book.
Now let's talk briefly about the death of Hyde. His body is found in Jekyll's lab. This is a sort of a climactic moment in the book. What happens in that scene?
So when Hyde's body is found, we find a letter that reveals the true nature of the relationship between Jekyll and Hyde and what happened. And this is the final chapter called Henry Jekyll's Full Statement of the Case. And it's Jekyll's confession, really, of his sin, of transforming into this evil being. So here's where the religious nature of the novella comes back into play and is brought out in full force. And we learn that Jekyll was trying to avoid turning into Hyde, but the effect of taking the potion that he took a few times to transform himself into Hyde had such an effect on him that he had been starting to transform into Hyde even without taking the potion. So he had begun to lose control over Hyde, over his evil self, and he was so concerned that one day he would transform into Hyde for good and not be able to transform back into Jekyll, that he would have to leave this note explaining the full case, the full disappearance of Jekyll, and we learn that everything comes back into full force. The religious, the gothic, all the elements, the science fiction and detective nature, they all come together and everything is revealed in this final bravura chapter.
So let's talk about the author, Robert Louis Stevenson. When you mention Robert Louis Stevenson, the first book people think of, I suppose, is Treasure Island, maybe his most famous work. But this one's a close second, would you say?
I would definitely say so. It kind of depends on your taste, whether you go for the more adventurous romance types of stories or the more gothic horror science fiction types. But in terms of cultural influence, I would say that Jekyll and Hyde has had more staying power. It's certainly been more popular in movie, film, and television adaptations.
So what's the best movie or TV version of Jekyll and Hyde?
Yeah, there have been so many. It's actually, Jekyll and Hyde is one of the most adapted stories or books of all time, ranking right up there with Dracula. There's a pretty good one in 1941, directed by Victor Fleming, the director of Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. It has an all-star cast with Spencer Tracy, Ingrid Bergman, Lana Turner, a very good one called Mary Riley in 1996, starring John Malkovich in the role of Jekyll and Hyde. But I would say the best one still is the first sound adaptation of Jekyll and Hyde from 1931, directed by Ruben Mamoulian. Frederick March won Best Actor Oscar for playing Jekyll and Hyde in a role that was so convincing that a lot of moviegoers thought that the part was played by two different actors.
And all of this, of course, sprang from the head of Robert Louis Stevenson. There's an interesting story about how he wrote it. What's the story behind the story?
Yeah, a really fascinating story. So we know a little bit about this from his wife, Fanny, and his stepson, Lloyd, who both wrote accounts of the story behind the story, but still some of the story is shrouded in mystery. What we know, at least what we think we know, is that Stevenson was working on some strange story. He told his stepson, Lloyd, that had come to him in a dream, and it was burning inside of him, and he just had to get it out of him. Every writer knows this feeling of when you have this idea, this creative idea, that's just like a fire burning in you. You have to get it out. So the story behind the story is kind of writing by exorcism, or the need to perform an auto exorcism to get this demon out of him, which heightens the whole gothic nature surrounding the story. And Stevenson wrote it out in 3 days in complete silence. After he wrote it out, he read the story aloud to his wife and stepson. And Fanny, his wife, was pretty disturbed by the story. We're not sure exactly why, if it was just the nature was too disturbing or she thought he didn't execute it well from a literary sense. So one account says that she threw the manuscript into a fire. Another account says Stevenson, upset by her reaction, threw the manuscript into the fire. But either way, it was gone, and then he needed to rewrite it again. So he rewrote it. He worked at an astonishing pace rewriting it. Most writers write maybe about 1,000 words a day. He wrote 10,000 words a day and writing it out. Just a stunning literary achievement.
Daniel Ross Goodman, we are out of time. Thanks so much for joining us on the Great Books Podcast.
My great pleasure.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. And please send me your ideas for future episodes on Twitter. My handle is @HayMiller. Also, check out our sponsor, Belmont Abbey College and its Great Books program. Go to belmontabbeycollege.edu/greatbooks. A life well lived awaits. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.